From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, shady backroom agreements and a potentially illegitimate marriage, why James Brown's estate is still a mess nearly 12 years after his death. And Duke Ellington's main musical partner, Billy Strayhorn, is the subject of a new work by choreographer David Rousseff.
You hear his music and you see the dances that, in a surreal and abstract way, are telling you what was maybe residing in his heart while you see the facts of his life before you.
And how Obama's re-election inspired an ambitious video installation, all that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcast supporters include National Geographic, presenting Free Solo, a film that follows climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream of climbing El Capitan in Yosemite National Park without a rope. Free Solo, now playing at the ArcLight Hollywood.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. When someone dies and there are assets to be divvied up among heirs, there's always the possibility that things will get messy. In the case of the dispute over James Brown's estate, the godfather of soul died in 2006, messy doesn't even begin to describe it. Brown was married four times. Disputes between his children, grandchildren, his fourth wife, and their one son have led to more than a dozen lawsuits. There are questions about how much Brown intended to give to charity and about the legitimacy of his last marriage. Add to that the intricacies of copyright law, and it gets very, very complicated. Hollywood Reporter senior editor Eric Gardner explained the questions surrounding Brown's fourth marriage.
James Brown married a woman named Tomi Ray, who was secretly married to another fellow, who in turn was secretly married to three other women. What happened was that in 1997, Tomi Ray married a Pakistani man who, after the wedding ceremony, had told her that he was already married to three women in Pakistan. Evidently, all he wanted was citizenship in the United States, and that's why the marriage occurred, and then he departed. So a few years go by, and James Brown marries this woman, and then she tells him the big secret, and that causes a big fight in the marriage and questions about whether or not they are truly married. And that question has been going on for more than a decade now.
And unlike Prince, James Brown did in fact have a will, but are there issues with his will, or what's the problem there?
James Brown did have a will, but it was never updated during the marriage with Tomi Ray. So after he died, she petitioned the court to alter it. She claimed that she was the surviving spouse, and as such, she would be entitled to pretty much half of the estate. The other children and grandchildren from James Brown's marriages don't like this. They, you know, question whether the marriage was legit. The administrators for the estate, too, had questions. So there's been big battles for the last decade about the nature of this marriage.
And it seems clear, too, from a cursory reading of the coverage of his will, that James Brown wanted to give this money away. And yet, it doesn't seem as if any money has been distributed yet. Is that correct?
Yeah. In his will, he earmarked a big portion of his estate to go to scholarships for needy children. But because of this fight, which has taken place for 12 years now and is still ongoing, all the money has gone to legal expenses. There has been not one penny paid out to charity.
There are more than a dozen lawsuits over his estate. Is there a common theme, at least to some of them?
The common theme that we're seeing is that, you know, it's just a big mess. There's all these sorts of interpretations of you know, what constitutes a marriage and, you know, how to divide assets. And with so many mouths to feed and so many people objecting, you know, it's just a big mess. You know, because there's charity involved, we even have the involvement of the Attorney General in South Carolina. And everyone has just been trying to figure this out. They've tried to get to settlements at certain points. But, you know, with an estate that's valued up to $100 million, there's a lot at stake. So there's a lot of fighting.
It's safe to say that his music is now and will continue to generate royalties on top of the valuation of the estate now, but it also sounds as if there's some copyright issues involving the estate. You wrote a little bit about termination rights. What's the issue there, and how does that affect the estate?
Sure. Well, as everyone knows, the term of copyright is pretty long. There are songs and books and other creative works from the late 20s on that are still under copyright. When Congress decided that they were going to extend the copyright term, they said to themselves, well, you know, perhaps we should give benefit to the authors who actually created these works. What usually happens is you're a young author. You want to make it in the industry, so you sign over the rights to your works for you know, very little. Those rights go to publishers or studios. Under the termination provisions of the copyright law, an author or his heirs is allowed to reclaim those rights during the later years of the copyright term. And what Congress wanted was not a very easy way for, you know, studios or publishers to manipulate it so that these termination rights would be signed away. So what we have here in the James Brown case are heirs who, you know, theoretically have these termination interests and, you know, questions about, you know, who gets to exploit them. And if they're not exploited, can there be deal making that happens that, you know, bolsters one party to the detriment of another? It's a very tough issue, very unsettled, and we haven't really seen anything like this in a court of law yet.
This is now 12 years into a legal fight. Is there any sign that any progress is being made on any of the cases? Could we see this wrapped up in the next year or two, or is it going to go on well beyond that?
Quite the opposite. You know, a few years ago, one might say that the parties were nearing a settlement. With the latest developments, including a new federal lawsuit, we are certainly years and years away from any sort of resolution. You know, the thing seems to be getting more complicated, not less. It's going up on appeal. There are new lawsuits being brought. There is absolutely no end in sight as of right now.
Eric Gardner is a senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter. He is the author of the article, James Brown Family Feud, Inside a 12-Year Fight Over Bigamy, DNA Tests, and Copyright Law. Eric, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, one of Duke Ellington's most important collaborators is recognized in a dance performance.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic, presenting Free Solo from the directors of Meru, hailed by critics as a stunning real-world thriller and an experience that will leave you in awe. Free Solo is the breathtaking portrait of climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream, climbing the face of the world's most famous rock, the 3,200-foot El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, without a rope. Free Solo is now playing at the ArcLight Hollywood.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. That's Take the A-Train, and a lot of people associate it with Duke Ellington. But very few people know that it was actually written by someone else. Billy Strayhorn was Ellington's longtime collaborator, writing partner, and arranger, yet he is largely forgotten in the history of jazz. Strayhorn, who died in 1967, was not only a gifted musician, but also a gay African-American man, growing up at a time in the country when being gay and being black was incredibly difficult, if not potentially deadly. Now, Strayhorn's life and work is being celebrated in a new dance piece called Halfway to Dawn. It's premiering at the Red Cat Theater in downtown Los Angeles. Its creator is the choreographer David Rousseff, and the dancers are from his L.A. company named Reality.
The company started actually in New York when I was living in the East Village way back in 1988. I started the company. It turned into, when I moved to Los Angeles in 1996, more of a project-to-project company. But because the projects take 4 to 5 years, it ends up being an ongoing collection of dancers. And I really love the technical physical and racial, ethnic diversity of the company. It's kind of all colors, sizes, shapes, genders, choices, persuasions. We kind of run the gamut.
So very much like Los Angeles and like the world, a lot of people have heard Billy Strayhorn's music,
yes,
but don't know that they've heard it because it has been largely attributed to Duke Ellington.
Exactly.
So before we talk about your show, let's talk about Billy and his music and his importance not only to Duke Ellington, but to music of the 20th century.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of people, and including myself. I had never heard of Billy Strayhorn before someone... I was working on another project that had Billy Strayhorn music, and I thought, who's this guy, Billy Strayhorn? And then I realized I've known his music my entire life, from A-Train to Lush Life to Something to Live For, UMMG, some of the best-known jazz ballads and anthems. And he's also, as far as he is known as being Duke Ellington's primary writing collaborator and also arranger. And kind of like today, where there's a fine line between, for example, sampling and composing, there certainly was a fine line then between arranging and composing.
So when people walk into a performance of Halfway to Dawn, if they don't know anything about Billy Strayhorn, it seems like a large part of your show is educational, that you were going to walk the audience through his accomplishments and what he meant to music. How would you say the components of history, dance, music, and also visual representations on screen behind the dancers come together to tell that story?
Part of the experiment of the piece, in asking ourselves as artists and myself as the creator of this work, how do you capture the deeper truths of a life? Or how do you get to know someone, including but also beyond the facts of the life? There was this amazing quote that I came across years ago in my research saying, everyone wants to know who Billy Strayhorn is, but if you listen to the music, he left the blueprint to his soul in his music. And so what I took that to mean is blueprint to his soul is his deeper emotional makeup is really invested in and reflected by his music. So what you see live is you hear his music and you see the dances that in a surreal and abstract way are telling you what was maybe residing in his heart while you see the facts of his life before you. And hopefully it's that boiling and simmering of fact and conjecture and dreams that you really get to know the deeper truths of Billy Strayhorn as a man.
We're talking with choreographer David Rusev about his new piece, Halfway to Dawn. There's such a joy and beauty, not only to his music, but also to your choreography with your company. And even as we're listening to beautiful music and watching beautiful choreography, we're seeing images behind them of very ugly things.
Yes.
Like the civil rights movement and African Americans who are getting hosed by law enforcement for
yes.
daring to sit at lunch counters and protest and try to have an equal voice in this country.
Yes.
Why is that important to you that you are trying to juxtapose the things that Billy Strayhorn was dealing with as not only an African-American, but a gay African-American with the beauty of the music and the dance that we see in front of her?
There are some narrative references to the civil rights footage that are explained in Act Two, which is that Billy Strayhorn was a direct activist, meaning he was directly engaged in the civil rights movement. He was there for the March on Washington. He was a good friend of Martin Luther King's, whereas Duke Ellington, which in its own way is equally valid, chose the path of, I'm the greatest superstar in the world and I'm African American. So that, in fact, is a form of protest and empowerment. But I really appreciated that by the end of his life, Billy Strayhorn had chosen to become directly engaged. But there's also a bigger dialogue there that I really appreciate your mentioning, which is that in general, overall to me, life is a direct juxtaposition or collision between the ugly and the beauty of it all. And I thought, that's the politics of the piece, actually. Right after this really gruesome imagery of the civil rights movement, and your mind really hasn't even had the chance to adjust, there is a transition where we go from anger to joy, but you're dwelling in this disturbing footage, and right away there's this raise the roof dance. And some of the feedback has been, gosh, you know, at first I didn't know should I be happy, sad? Am I? But by the end of that dance, I'm actually so filled with joy and I'm there with the dancers. And I thought, that's the polemics of this piece. Yes, we're going to fight. We're going to be present and acknowledge reality, but we're also going to reclaim our joy, its dignity, and humanity.
How do you think narrative dance in a piece like this advances the story of Billy Strayhorn? What do you think it tells us that text and music can't?
That's such a great question. Thank you for asking that, because that's something I think about all the time. You can convey ideas, really concrete ideas, through words, but dance and music can bring forth the poetry of the human soul, especially in my case, that there's a poetry and a metaphoric language that for me can excavate the emotional terrain more so than words can.
A choreographer's most important relationship creatively is with his or her dancers, but you also have some really important collaborators. I want to ask you about your sound designer, Dee Sabella Grimes, and what sound design means to you and why it's important to this piece.
Dee Sabella Grimes is this amazing performance artist, choreographer, composer, who works in urban sounds and music and languages, but vital to this piece, especially in Act Two. Sabella has this brilliant ongoing sound design where in Act One, it's a little more literal. It's based on sounds that you would hear in a honky-tonk club down south in the 1960s or 50s. Abstractions of sounds from a civil rights march. And then in Act Two, though, there's this nonstop background of sound design that Sabella created that takes us more inside Strayhorn's head. And they're all electronic sounds that start to actually fall apart as Strayhorn's life does begin to somewhat fall apart by the end. It was really clear he began drinking and smoking way too much. And Sabella's sound design starts to reflect that kind of the decomposition of Strayhorn himself rather than the decomposition of his music.
Strayhorn was an activist and an artist at the same time, and that was evidenced in a couple of things: the music that he wrote and the partnerships that he formed with people like Martin Luther King Jr., but also that he led his life openly, that he was a gay African-American man when it was very difficult to be both, let alone one, at the same time. So in terms of the lessons that he set for people like you, for any artist, yeah, what do you take away from his life and what he did as an activist and an artist?
When I first was introduced to Billy Strayhorn through his music, I was blown away to be out, gay, living in Harlem and living with your life partner slash boyfriend in the late 1930s, straight up to when he died in 1964. I thought the gutsiness of that and the commitment to, I'm going to live my personal truth at all costs, could be threatening to one's life during the late 1930s to live out with your boyfriend anywhere in this country and be gay. And that's actually what I really felt so strongly about as a gay African-American myself. If I thought that was hard, you know, decades ago coming out to my family and friends, can you imagine socially when literally people's lives are being taken for being gay, people's lives are being taken for being African-American? And to have the double, what could have been a double whammy, but in Strayhorn's case became a double beauty. That was such a statement for me. And that's probably one of the, if not the most important reason for me to feel compelled to tell this story.
David Rousseff is a choreographer. His world premiere, Halfway to Dawn, will be at the Red Cat Theater from October 4th to the 7th. David, great to see you. Thanks for
coming. Thank you so much. I'm so honored.
Coming up, how a love of America and ABBA collide in an art installation at the Broad Museum. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. There's an oddly shaped room at the Broad Museum where, on any given day, you might find people sitting on the floor and listening to music. That's where the video installation The Visitors is mounted. The piece is composed of 9 video screens. 8 feature musicians who are set up in 8 different parts of a decrepit mansion that's equal parts antique and bohemian. The 9th video is of the front porch, where a group of people sing and occasionally shoot off an old cannon. It's completely mesmerizing. The Visitors was created by Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson in 2012, and the frame's Darby Maloney reached him by Skype in Reykjavik to find out how this piece came to be.
The idea for The Visitors came many years ago. I mean, it's a piece from a totally different era. I would never have made this piece today.
We believe in a generous America, in a compassionate America, in a tolerant America.
I was just so excited about America back then. It was like 2012 in the Obama time, and felt like sort of liberal ideas were unstoppable and everybody was in it together. And I was like a citizen in the American empire being in love with America. My name is Ragnar Kjartansson and I'm a visual artist and I live in Reykjavik, Iceland. Also, I had been very much in love with this house, Rokeby House. It was built in 1815 by John Armstrong, who was a commander in Washington's army in the War of Independence. It's one of the kind of last houses upstate New York to be still owned by the same old grand 19th century family. And it's absolutely a place of magic. And then there came this idea about to film it with my friends from the Reykjavik music scene, to just fill it up with song so that each room would sort of vibrate with music. In the room where Kristín Anna is playing the accordion, there is a, like on the piano, there is a flute. John Armstrong, like the one who built the house, he would play that flute in the trenches in the War of Independence. There's like the flute of freedom and a pack of Doritos by it. And I mean, all the rooms that we are in are just like historic in their ways. And like the room where Cesat is playing the banjo and the baritone guitar, that's where like Teddy Roosevelt would sit by the fire with Bob Chandler, who lived in the house, and they would like discuss if America should enter the world and, you know, become a player in foreign politics and stuff like that. It's like these things really happened in that house. So like, it's really like, you enter a museum on American history, but it's a home. It was 9 cameras and 9 microphones scattered around the building, and then all just recorded at exactly the same time. In one frame, it's me playing acoustic guitar in the bathtub, and so I would play like guitar and a little bit water percussion and vocals. And then it's cello, drums, baritone guitar and banjo, piano, accordion, the guitar, bass, hurdy-gurdy. And then out on the porch, there's a choir with all the inhabitants of Rokeby. It was quite a kick recording it. I really remember that very fondly. How you could feel like all the rooms around you just being full of music. And then suddenly you hear a cannon outside and all these things. The title comes from this record called The Visitors by the Swedish mega pop group ABBA, and basically a homage, because I really love ABBA. I had a problem with the title, and then I just found it in the record collection on this album sleeve, and it almost looks like on the cover they're also like in some gloomy big mansion. There's a great song on that album which is like, one of us is crying, one of us is lying. I really like that song. I think that's my favorite song from the record, just this line, one of us is crying, one of us is lying. Really like pretty hardcore Scandinavian pain for you. For there's never really an ideal way to see it. It's just like, it's really a piece which you can just like walk through and just like see it as kind of singing paintings and just like, okay, I get it, and just walk out. Or you can just linger into it and sort of be immersed in all its seductive sentimentality. Actually, I think it's just really appropriate that it's in Los Angeles now. It's fun, like you make a piece and it goes somewhere and it was not intended to be there, but it just like, it just makes sense there. And I'm just, of course, delighted that it's like being shown in the good old capital of show business. I love the movies and I love LA and I'm really happy that it's there. And now when, like, you know, when California is like, it's like fighting for its liberalism in this new state of America, I think it's just good to have this memorial for good old American liberalism.
Ragnar Kjartansson's installation The Visitors is at the Broad Museum in downtown LA. And that's the show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.